You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, September 10th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. The fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Tim Carr, the battle for the net. It's Internet Slowdown Day. Also on the program today, Cuomo the Humbled. He was so angry that he had to have a primary. He didn't even come out to say he won.
How can I say I won if it never happened?
Also on the program today, September 10th. Hopefully we won't be talking about this day in another 12 years as we start our next war, as announced by President Obama tonight. More reasons why this is BS. And if Michael wants to argue with me, he can do so. Also,
really, after we put some makeup on Sam, but the beatdown I gave him in the office yesterday, I'm surprised he won again.
All right, enough. Also on the program today, Jesus is back, this time on a pierogi.
What?
Yeah. All that and more on today's program. Oh, and, you know, we may also get to the story. We talked about this in the funner half yesterday, about this story of the DA in Massachusetts of Bristol County, I believe it was, who didn't drop charges but essentially negotiated a plea deal with two guys who led a protest by blocking a boat that was providing a huge delivery of coal to a factory in Somerset, Mass. And very brave move by this DA, which hopefully will spark similar actions around the country. You know, we've seen some of this by prosecutors around the country when it comes to things like marriage equality. DA refuses to insist that, let's say, a county commissioner or clerk stop issuing licenses for marriage equality. Hopefully this is the beginning of seeing this, where we have local officials who understand the urgency of what's happening with our climate and begin to send a message by using prosecutorial discretion. And this is all, of course, leading up to a major march that will take place in New York 11 days from now, as the UN begins to try and forge essentially a new non-binding, so they don't have to basically get the U.S. Senate to approve, treaty, if you will, on cutting carbon emissions. We'll, of course, be talking about that a lot more as we go forward. Also on the program tomorrow, we will be talking about President Obama's speech tonight, but we're going to want to talk about a couple of aspects of this, of our new Iraq war. I guess apparently now it is a requirement of every president that they have a new Iraq war. So, all right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, a quick interview with Tim Carr so that you are reminded of the issue of net neutrality. We'll be back in just a moment. We are back. Sam Seder, Majority Report on the phone. Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy for FreePress.net. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Sam, how are you?
I'm doing well. I am really. I was gonna suggest that maybe we just talk in slow motion today to push the point. But it is Internet Slowdown Day. What does that mean? What's going on?
Well, Internet Slowdown is a day of action where hundreds of websites, tech companies, advocacy organizations have joined together to display on their websites what a lot of people call the spinning circle of death, the slow-loading icon that so many people are familiar with when they have that frustrating experience of trying to load a video or a music file on the Internet. And we put that on all of our websites, and it allows people to click through to an action where they can ask the Federal Communications Commission to protect real net neutrality. So there are a lot of organizations across the web, companies like Tumblr, Twitter, and Netflix, and are taking part, and we're hoping to really generate a lot of letters to the FCC and also phone calls to Congress today.
All right. Now, we've talked about net neutrality quite a bit on this program. Where are we following this court case? I guess it was maybe back in January, where I know a lot of folks like yourself had been anticipating that court case and anticipating more or less the outcome, which was that the scheme that the FCC tried to create to regulate the ability of Internet providers to basically choose one service over another in terms of creating a multiple-tiered Internet was going to fail because they refused ultimately to go back to reclassify. Tell us where we are in terms of that reclassification and just remind people what that means.
Sure. So the Federal Communications Commission has consistently got net neutrality wrong. What this FCC, the FCC under President Obama, has been trying to do is fulfill the president's pledge to support strong net neutrality protections. However, the FCC, because it is very beholden to powerful and phone and cable industry lobbyists, a lot of FCC employees go on to work for the phone and cable lobby, hasn't done it right.
Well, to be fair, let me just say, Tom Wheeler, the chair of the FCC, already worked for that industry, right?
Yeah, Tom Wheeler was the chief lobbyist for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association, the top lobby group, before he came to the FCC. So the revolving door does spin in both directions. But what they have consistently gotten this wrong, and what they haven't done is reversed a decision that was made in 2002-2003 by a Bush-era FCC chairman, Michael Powell, who just so happens today to have taken Tom Wheeler's job as the top lobbyist for the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. But when Powell was the chairman, he reclassified Internet service providers under what's called Title I of the Telecommunications Act. He took them out of a common carrier designation of Title II, and that created this massive legal mess because in order for the FCC to truly protect net neutrality, to stop Internet service providers from discriminating or blocking or slowing your access to websites, they need Title II authority in order to do that. So what we've been asking and what we're asking today through this mass day of action is to give the new FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, the backing, the political support that he needs to do the right thing, fix that problem from the Bush era, and restore common carrier status to Internet service providers so that they can no longer block or prevent our access to websites or services that we may want to use.
Now, when we talk about common carrier status, and we talk about basically reclassifying the Internet as falling under Title II, we're basically saying this is a telecommunications utility like the phone.
Well, it's not really. If you reclassify, if you make a company like Comcast behave as a common carrier, you're not automatically transforming that into a utility. There are plenty of private enterprises that are common carriers. In fact, Disney roller coasters were ruled common carriers. We are talking right now via a privately controlled network that is a common carrier. So the issue of whether or not Internet should be like a public utility is a slightly different discussion. What we're trying to do is provide a common carrier rule for Internet service providers. And it really is the only way that you can protect free speech over private networks. And there's a long history of common carriage rules that go all the way back to the telegraph that were intended to do just that.
So let me ask you this. When they reclassified, and when we talk about the FCC has gotten it wrong, or they don't have the political backing to make this move, I mean, to stay within the sort of like the tech parlance, when the Internet was reclassified, was it a feature or a bug that made it so hard to impose net neutrality?
Well, you know, actually, net neutrality was built into the DNA of the Internet at its inception. So, I mean, the Internet itself is a network that was built along this engineering principle called the end-to-end principle, which basically said that all of the choice exists at the edges of the network and not in the middle. And that was an engineering principle that was figured out by academics and Defense Department engineers way back in the 60s when we were crafting the Internet. Little did they know was that idea was very politically relevant, because when you apply it to media networks, what an end-to-end principle means is that there are no gatekeepers, that we as Internet users get to decide who we connect with, what services we use, what news sites we want to go to. We might want to listen to your radio program rather than having to listen to or watch CNN.com or something else. It gives us the power to choose. And so that end-to-end principle removed the gatekeeper. So it's part of the way the Internet has always worked, but unfortunately the phone and cable lobby has wanted to change that because they're not happy with just selling you an Internet connection. You know, you may pay 40, 50, 60, 70, I don't know how much you might pay for your Internet connection. It varies from place to place. And the deal that they strike with you is that, you know, we're going to connect you to the Internet, and then we're going to get out of your way. Well, now they want to get back into their way. And in order to do that, they need to re-engineer the Internet, kill this principle of net neutrality, so that they can begin to discriminate in favor of websites and services that pay them more.
That pay them more, that they may, in fact, own in many instances, right? I mean, this is a sort of the classic Sinn Féin type of situation. But let me get back to my question. My question was that when Powell reclassified it, and when Tom Wheeler shows some measure of reluctance to do so, is it because they're just not intelligent enough to realize what could happen? Or is it because, in fact, that they don't like this idea of end-to-end, this end-to-end structure, and that their buddies in the industry can make more money if it doesn't exist?
It's because they're political animals, and they live inside a bubble, which is Washington, D.C., where the phone and cable lobby is thought to hold, all power over the political process. And they have been told in no uncertain terms by the phone and cable lobby that to reclassify internet service providers as common carriers is, quote, the nuclear option, unquote. And they are so fearful of upsetting that lobby that they're willing to ignore the overwhelming public support for net neutrality. Now, the FCC has opened its docket for comments for several months now. They opened it in May. And in that time, there have been 1.4 million comments. There'll be a lot more going in today because of the internet slowdown. That is the most comments that they have received on any rulemaking in their history. And the Sunlight Foundation, which you're probably familiar with, a transparency organization, went in and looked at all of those comments, and they found that 99% said they supported strong net neutrality rules. Now, if you ever want an indication of public support for an issue, having 99% in favor is a pretty good indication, and hopefully it should put wind in your sails if you are someone like Chairman Tom Wheeler, who wants to actually do that to protect net neutrality by reclassifying. Unfortunately, they are these political creatures who live inside Washington, and they think that the decisions that are made by phone and cable lobbyists are far more important than what millions of Americans are demanding via their own open docket.
So we're talking about, at this point, nearly, I don't know, about one out of every 200 breathing Americans, regardless of age, has commented on this. That's pretty stunning. That's a stunning amount of feedback.
Well, there have been more, because that's just the comments that have occurred at the FCC. We've also, Free Press works with a lot of other organizations on this issue, including Move On, including Credo, all of whom have fairly large memberships, and we've been engaging them in a whole number of ways this year. We've put calls into Congress, letters to the White House. We tallied up our respective lists and counted the number of actions that have occurred in 2014, and that number exceeds 4 million.
Wow.
So in fairness, some of these lists, the membership overlaps, so that doesn't really mean 4 million individuals, but it does mean 4 million individual actions were taken. So this is an issue that even, we've admitted is kind of techie. It gets really wonky. It's hard to understand. Net neutrality is kind of a strange term, but for some reason it now seems to be resonating across a fairly significant portion of the American population.
So just lastly, let's talk about the businesses involved. I saw that the CEO of Etsy was basically saying our business really could fold in the absence of reclassification ultimately. You mentioned Netflix. Put into context Netflix participation in this based upon the fact that they earlier this year had made a deal, I think it was with Verizon or Comcast. Did what they do in terms of paying for a I don't know if it can be characterized as a higher level of service, but they made some deal which some people felt was a threat to net neutrality. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, a company like Netflix is facing an existential crisis, right? If internet service providers have the right to degrade their service, then they lose their business. And, a company like Comcast, which is also in the business of providing streaming video and its own cable television business, has the incentive to undermine Netflix. So they are facing an existential crisis, and I think they've signed these deals really with a gun to their head. But then their CEO has since come out and said, this was really horrible. we shouldn't have to do this. We're strongly in support of net neutrality. Now, Netflix is just one company that's involved, but they, you know, this list includes Tumblr and Twitter, Kickstarter, a lot of companies, Reddit is very involved, that have become supporters of this day of action, the Internet slowdown, have a business model that's built on this idea of the open Internet. So it's in their interests as companies to see that the open Internet thrives. And we're happy that that interest aligns with the interests of a lot of Internet users out there who also want to be able to go to these websites and websites that might compete with them without our ISP telling us whether that's okay or not.
All right, so where should people go to get more information and to be able to I know you have basically a gateway that provides that sends people to where to comment for the FCC.
Yeah, and if you're on any of your favorite websites today and you see that spinning icon, you click through, and that will take you to battleforthenet.com, which is the coalition website. The coalition that's organizing this is Free Press, Demand Progress, Fight for the Future, and Engine Advocacy. So those four groups have been organizing the companies and other advocacy groups. So you go to battleforthenet.com. You can take action and call your members of Congress and contact the FCC. We also have a lot of resources on this at freepress.net.
And then what happens next? These comments go in. When does the comment period close? And then when do we anticipate the next move by the FCC?
Well, the FCC's comment period closes on September 15th, so we have a few days left before that closes. The FCC is then supposed to look at all of the comments that come in and make a decision, and we hope that they actually read these comments and that they listen to the American public and they make the right decision. Now, that decision could come down by the end of this year or early next year.
All right, there we have it. Tim Carr, Senior Director of Strategy from freepress.net. It is battleforthenet.com. We, of course, linked to it at majority.fm. We would have put the code in, but we're a little short-handed when it comes to people being able to put code in our website. We've got an old-fashioned link. So
battleforthenet.com will get you there. So
all right, great.
That works.
All right, Tim Carr, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
All right, folks. Wanted to take some time now to, obviously, very important to this program, because, you know, somebody like probably Marin would Bigfoot us and take up all the extra bandwidth. He'd be able to buy the extra bandwidth for streaming and whatnot. But, I mean, ultimately, look, what is happening in our media is fairly obvious. Things are becoming more and more niche. Soon, there'll be more and more, you know, you have outfits like HuffPost Live and Washington Post TV. I actually think there is something like that. Bloomberg TV, on and on and on. And we're all going to be in competition. And, of course, they have a huge advantage because they have the resources to market themselves better than we do. And the competency in the office sometimes to market themselves better than we do. But what they will not be able to do if we have genuine net neutrality is to provide a better quality stream or a more reliable stream than we can. And that's really what this fight is about. So if you have yet to make a comment to the FCC, do so now. All right, let's get to what took place in New York. There were primaries in about five states around the country. Scotty B. won in his primary in New Hampshire.
Oh, was I'm it New sorry. I apologize. What did I just do? Oh, I just won a freaking primary, brah.
There you go. Now what does he do? Is he moved to Vermont and run for the primary there? Dude, I'm gonna hit every state in New England.
I'm still running. I don't know why you assume. And secondly, Vermont. I mean, come on, dude. That's like last resort.
Dude, I'm going to head down to Rhode Island. I'm not even going to run for the Senate. I'm just going to run for the primary so I can say that I did it in five states.
I won primaries in all five New England states. I'm going to crush a friggin'
I haven't been on a tour like this since I saw Hootie and the Blowfish. All right. So, of course, big primary in New York State. In New York State yesterday. Andrew Cuomo and Kathy Hochul running on the ballot against Zephyr Teachout. Well, for governor, it was Zephyr Teachout and Randy Credico. And Hochul was running against Tim Wu. The amount of people who voted in this primary was extraordinarily low. The last real contested Democratic primary, I think, was Spitzer's in 06. And I literally think there was a couple hundred thousand more voters, 20% larger turnout than in this one. There was about 500,000 votes cast, maybe 550,000 cast in this primary. It's an extraordinary small amount. Was it 7% of the population of the?
I think it was 10. I'm still 10. Looking, I've heard 10.
Andrew Cuomo, as of 11 a.m. this morning, got 62% of the vote. Teachout got 34% plus. Randy Credico got about 4% of the vote. Understand that this these numbers may not sound terribly impressive to you. I can tell you that in the New York political press and in the national political press, people are shocked. Shocked. Because the sheer name recognition value in and of itself should have meant that Teachout could have maybe gotten 20%. I think Credico was always going to get about 3 to 4%. The dollar amount, also shocking disparity as well. In the corridor of Amtrak going from New York City to Albany, I think Teachout and Wu won all of those counties. They won in Manhattan. They won 78% in Columbia County, where I'm registered to vote. And that is basically because there was no other vote on the ballot. It was just the primary for the governorship. There was no other primaries, at least in Hudson, New York. And Matt Stoller has a good piece on the five reasons why Cuomo won. They're worth going through. And again, you know, for me, ultimately, this was not about Cuomo. I mean, I should say it was not about rating Zephyr Teachout as a candidate. For me, it was always about voting against Cuomo. And I don't know if Zephyr Teachout was the best protest candidate, but she was the most prominent one. So here's what Stoller wrote. Cuomo won because he spent more than $11 million on TV alone, while Zephyr Teachout spent $500,000 on the whole campaign. Wow. She didn't do one piece of mail, not a single TV ad. Cuomo paid roughly $48 for every vote he got. Zephyr Teachout paid roughly $2.70. You know, Cuomo was so pissed that he didn't even give a victory speech. Kathy Hochul gave some type of interview, and that was basically it. Cuomo's pissed. He was embarrassed. I don't know that Cuomo had any legitimate national aspirations, but to the extent that anybody else subscribed to his legitimate national aspirations, we have just been spared all the talk in the media. Let's put it that way. The liberal establishment went for Cuomo. You'll recall that the WFP endorsed Cuomo. I think they did so fairly reluctantly. They made a deal with Cuomo, ostensibly that will give the Democrats ostensibly control of the Senate in New York. Remains to be seen if Cuomo will screw them over on that deal. But that was the deal that they made. Many of the unions that support the WFP wanted to endorse Cuomo because they have a very transactional relationship with Cuomo. And over the past year, he's tried to build some bridges or mend some bridges with them. Hillary Clinton did a robocall for Cuomo, which was interesting insofar as she did very little else for any other candidates in 2014 at this point. Kirsten Gillibrand, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Emily's List endorsed the Cuomo Hochul ticket. Bill de Blasio, I think he did some robocalls for Cuomo.
Where's Bill de Blasio?
Oh!
And also showed up just in time for Cuomo to pretend like he didn't see Zephyr Teachout.
Didn't de Blasio, though, look a little thrown off by that?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
He was like, dude, like,
why
are
you so
doing?
Excited to see me?
Like, you didn't have a reaction like this when I was trying to get kids pre-K.
Right.
I'll tell you that much, buddy.
Where's the mayor?
All right. Here's number three by Matt Stoller. He calls Zephyr's base the Occupy voter bloc. Some in Occupy may take issue with that, but that's the way that he named it. It's not a complete coalition, but it's piece of a broader coalition. And it's basically, I think, in Stoller's description, sort of white liberals from ages 30 to 45 years, which he considers to be the Occupy Wall Street demographic. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's the way he characterizes it. He says, Cuomo will be governor, but his career is over. Cuomo will win in November. He will govern for another 4 years, or until he is indicted, because he's proved himself a very good machine boss, but a very bad candidate. I think that's very accurate. And I think I think what this campaign has done, at least in terms of Cuomo's career, is it's exposed him as being a guy who is just that. A very good machine boss, but a very piss-poor candidate, making very stupid decisions along the way, including contesting Teachout's residency and her signatures and pretending she wasn't in the race. He's a bad candidate. Number five, New York establishment hates and fears Cuomo. This basically is tied into his machine quality. I mean, when there was talk about the WFP challenging Cuomo in the general election, I had talked to various leaders around, who are involved in activism, but also in providing services. And the one thing that shocked me was many of them were saying it can't get worse than Cuomo. Like, even if it meant he lost an election, he has so damaged us that it can't get worse than him. He is so vindictive.
Wow.
And I was shocked by that. Stoller contends that Cuomo's control of the party is in question. His ability to govern will be dramatically weakened. He will be governor, but no longer king. I'm not sure. Cuomo is incredibly vindictive. There's also no term limits in New York. Now, he may not want to be governor for four terms, but he might just to say that he's better than his dad. Stoller goes on to talk about Zephyr Teachout's career just beginning. In some respects, I think this may be the case. I don't know. Then, you know, judge her candidacy in other elections based upon not who she's running against, but what she'll bring to the candidacy. He goes on to say this is a real debate of ideas. My only concern is that Cuomo's corruption became such a big part of this election because he's so corrupt that some of the other issues took a back seat to the narrative of Cuomo governing like a Republican on economic issues. Stoller goes on to say that he thinks that antitrust is an extremely potent issue. I'm not so sure about that, but it may be the case that people are excited about it. And he goes on, number five, de Blasio's running for the governorship and then the presidency. He's not a throwback Democrat. He's a slightly more left-wing version of Bill Clinton or Barack Obama.
I don't know if he quite has that charisma level.
But it's true. He may not have that level of charisma. But that's probably where his politics are.
He's liberal.
I think that that's true. He's not left. He's not radical. He's probably more genuinely liberal than, like, Stoller's saying, than either of those two guys.
I don't know. I think that remains to be seen.
Yeah.
I think that remains to be seen. But I think it's a fair assessment of where de Blasio is at this point. And he's no Bloomberg. All right. I want to talk briefly.
Well, you got that right.
Listen, I spoke about this at length yesterday, but I want to talk about it more because tonight President Obama is giving a national address at 9 p.m. and he will more than likely announce that he has the authority to strike ISIS not only in Iraq, nominally in defense of specific U.S. interests in Iraq, like an embassy, or for humanitarian purposes, like in protecting the Yazidis, but that he has the authority to strike them in Syria. He will be seeking funds from Congress to train Syrian moderate, in quotation, rebels. There are reports out that the CIA is basically running the Free Syrian Army at this point, that they are sending weapons directly to specific fighting units in Syria. He's going to want to look to broaden that authority and make it full-fledged. Supposedly, they're going to be looking for a 36-month, and they'll say month, timeline, because 3 years sounds worse. And what you will not hear is, and he will say, no boots on the ground, but of course that's what they're saying today. What you will not hear is a description on really that ISIS is an imminent threat to the United States. Because no one in the intelligence services has made that claim. In fact, to the contrary, all of the intelligence services have said that ISIS is not an imminent threat to the United States. They may be a threat to some U.S. interests in the region. But does that warrant another war is the question you should be asking. And my answer is no on that accord. The other question you should be asking when you hear President Obama speak tonight is, what does success look like? We're going to wipe out ISIS with just air power? No.
No, we've got to back other groups.
No. And if it was possible that air power and these assorted groups on the ground were able to deal with ISIS, why couldn't they? Why have it been so ineffective in the first place? The idea that we're going to have these other groups are going to defeat ISIS after we do some strategic bombing seems ridiculous. But even then, how many more years later do we have to wait for the Uber ISIS that will grow? They'll change their name. But just like our actions created Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which mutated in some respects into ISIS, what will be the next name of the next group that we will create? There's also plenty of, at least studies, which show intervening in civil wars does nothing but elongate them. So the final question that you should be asking when you hear tonight is, under what authority can the president drop bombs in Syria, where we have no embassy and where we have no U.S. vital interests, or I should say anything that is American per se? And so there are basically three bills in the Congress right now that purport to give President Obama authority to take this action. But understand, as Jack Kingston, the Georgia Republican congressman, said in the New York Times, I think it was yesterday, a lot of people would like to stay on the sideline and say, just bomb the place and tell us about it later. It's an election year. A lot of Democrats don't know how it would play in their party, and Republicans don't want to change anything. We like the path we're on now. We can denounce it if it goes bad and praise it if it goes well and ask him what took him so long. Now, Kingston, to his credit, wants a vote. He's not going to get one. And the real question is, you know, are we going to see any Democrats in Congress? I mean, there are some of them that are demanding a vote. Adam Schiff, Democrat from California, apparently wants one. The CPC is keeping its powder dry, so to speak, until they hear what President Obama has to say. But the idea that they wouldn't demand at least a vote to authorize is just the ultimate in cowardice. Right now, there are three proposals, I guess. I don't know that they're quite bills yet. One in the House was presented by Frank Wolf. He introduced a bill that, according to Hayes Brown at Think Progress, one analyst has referred to as insanely broad. It lists at least four terrorist groups that the administration has the right to target as well as, quote, any other emerging regional terrorist groups that share a common violent extremist ideology with such terrorist groups, regional affiliates, or emerging terrorist groups. Basically, anybody. There's no time limit for that authorization. It is indefinite. So President Cruz or President Clinton will be able to continue under that authorization and seems to allow them boots on the ground when they want to put those in. There are two options in the Senate. James Inhofe has a bill where the president is given a wide range of latitude to act just against a smaller list of targets. He would use all necessary and appropriate force in order to defend the national security of the United States against the threat posed by ISIS. Authorization for the use of force against the organization called the Islamic State would also demand the Obama administration provide updates to Congress every 15 days and then a series of, or I should say every 90 days. The third proposal, Bill Nelson from Florida, has a bill where the president would be able to use appropriate force against ISIS to prevent terrorist attacks on the people and interests of the United States and our allies, but it specifically bars the president from deploying rotational ground troops. And it also includes a sunset clause of 36 months. So that's what's on the table right now. And, of course, the media is drumming the is beating the war drums. And my understanding is that they will not now paint a picture of you and hang it in the White House if you're a president unless you have a war with Iraq. That is now one of the requirements. So understand that the president's under a lot of pressure because it would suck.
Little thing called signing statements.
That's right. I changed the law. Got to avenge my father. Everybody gets a new Iraq war. That's just the way it is. That way, when the history books get written, I don't look like so much of a jerk off. So if you want that, picture painted of you in the White House to hang up on a wall, gotta attack Iraq.
History will judge me and you.
That's right. Don't worry. Don't worry, Barry. We won't be alive. Just let the historians decide that. And if you want, once you attack, I'll paint the picture myself.
History's a long way out, right, man?
In other words, right back at you. All right, we're going to take a break, head into the funner half. Went a little long, but I want to talk about that this thing tonight. We will talk about his speech tomorrow as well. But, you know, the idea, and Greenwald put it quite well in a piece that he wrote at The Intercept. And I put this to you, Michael.
Yeah, put it to me.
Put it to Michael.
If... And we'll talk about it in the second half.
In the second,
but here's the question:
the non-fun part of the fun half.
The non-fun part of the fun half. If ISIS is such a threat to the United States, a unique threat to the United States, that you would said unique yesterday.
It is unique. I didn't say unique threat to the United States.
All right.
Let's just be really clear about what I'm saying before we jump off the rails here.
If it is such a threat.
It's a unique
thing.
Okay.
If it's such a unique thing and such a threat to justify
what's already happened, which is all I've said.
Well,
but finish your thought.
Oh, really? You didn't say expanded strikes? Oh, no?
No, and I think there was even an email that actually said that I hadn't said that on
Monday. Piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
But anyways,
all right.
Finish your thought.
Well, ostensibly what we've done at this point is to protect directly American interests in Iraq.
Also some humanitarian things as well, for sure.
Yeah, but direct humanitarian crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay.
If you now you're going to back up and say that
no, I'm not backing. I want you to finish your thought because I'm happy to debate.
Here's the question that Greenwald has.
Yes.
If it is enough of a threat to justify airstrikes, why not boots on the ground? Because the American public.
Whole argument,
don't answer.
No, I just
don't
have
answer.
To say really quickly.
No. The American public. You can answer the question in the better half. The American public says that they are overwhelmingly in favor of more airstrikes, but at least a plurality is against boots on the ground. Doesn't make sense. All right, we're going to take a break.
True.
We're going to head into we're going to head to the fighter half. The number is 646-257-3920. You want to be a part of the program? Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. You know, we always hit these patches where we get emails from people and they can no longer afford to be members. And we never exclude anyone from membership because of financial reasons. And if you ever have a problem, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com. But we want to grow and maintain this program. And it's, like I say, 98% of our revenue is from our members. We're looking into maybe putting advertising in the on a more consistent basis in the free half. Maybe that'll drive people to become members more. Maybe we'll raise some money. We'll see. But if you can become a member, go to jointhemajorityreport.com right now. Also, if you buy crap from Amazon, majorityreportkickback.com. Click the link, buy your Amazon crap, we get a kickback. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. See you in the better half, 646-257-3920.
Whoops, wrong one.
646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me through the app at majorityapp.com. We'll be right back.
Satan,